Greetings, friends, and welcome to the Decaledge podcast, a companion to the Decaledge blog. I'm Matt Boutte, your author and host. My guest today is Becca Stevens. Becca is a speaker, justice entrepreneur, author, priest, and founder and president of Thistle Farms. She's been featured on PBS NewsHour, The Today Show, CNN, ABC World News, named a CNN hero and White House champion of change, holds 5 honorary doctorates, and raised over $75 million in funding for justice initiatives. Drawn from 25 years of leadership and mission-driven work, Becca leads important conversations across the country with an inspiring message that love is the strongest force for change in the world. I'm grateful to Becca for her time, and I'm happy to be able to share this conversation with you. Becca's passion for her work is infectious, and I hope it inspires you to see the good in this world and to go share it. And now, please enjoy my conversation with Becca Stevens. Becca Stevens, welcome to the Decaledge podcast.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I'm glad we could make it work. Becca, you know, this podcast is really around writers and how and why they write what they write and around books, but not infrequently, we tend to stray into discussions of vocation as well. And so I'm really curious about 3 of your vocations. One of them, obviously, your life as a writer, but I'm also really curious about you as an Episcopal priest and how you came to that work. And then thirdly, not insignificantly, your work, I want to phrase it around Thistle Farms, but it's bigger than that, I know. And so I don't know if you identify with the label activist or if we need to label it at all. But those are the 3 vocations. I'm really curious about how you came to those. And really what I see is the importance of the language that you use with each of those vocations. So maybe if you would talk about where you came from and how you grew up and how that brought you to these vocations.
Sure. And for the, just clarifying, the term that I like, I don't really love activist or, you know, whatever, but I do love justice entrepreneur.
Okay. I like that too.
That I create businesses and entrepreneurial activities as a means to further a mission. No, it's not social enterprise where you're trying to do business and then do some social good on the back end. It's this idea that if we are going to engage in true justice work, that we have to be willing to engage the marketplace. And so I think of myself as a justice entrepreneur that understands that the workforce for me is the mission and that we have to reevaluate, you know, all the links in a market chain and really elevate the place of the producer in that market chain. So that's where my head is and where my thought is on that. But as far as like, you know, when I grew up in the South, I love story like, you know, it's how I kind of come to understanding. Sometimes, like, I give you an example. When I read Emily Dickinson, and then I have to read somebody that can help explain Emily Dickinson, and then I have to look up the word enigmatic to remember what that means. Like, I get lost sometimes in a beautiful way. Getting lost is a beautiful thing. But I really thrive in story. Like, story I can get, and then I can extrapolate the larger meaning or the universal meaning. And I do think that comes from just a Southern culture that loves a good story, just loves it. My mom was a social worker and my dad was a priest. My dad died when I was little, grew up in a community center that was like the hub of my life. And so I have a lot of that in me where you are creating place that's part of the story, where you're creating community that's part of that story. And I think those influences really had a lot to do with how was it that I ended up a priest who was trying to create community that was telling a different story?
Yeah. Did you grow up, were those stories predominantly oral? Did you have books that you were reading a lot as you were growing up? How did that work for you?
I think it was primarily oral. I think a lot of it was in church, hearing stories in church. You know, church was a big part of my life, good and bad. That was the place after my dad died and the mission he had started, where I first experienced abuse. So it was a kind of scary place and not all the stories were good. But, you know, a lot of my mom's stories, I was raised, you know, as they say, corn fed. I was story fed by my mom. She was amazing at telling stories and she could help us kind of see the world not as a series of bad things that happen, but a reframing of how lucky we are through story.
I love that. Did you grow up thinking you were going to go into the ministry? Did you grow up thinking you were going to do something else?
You know, women weren't ordained when I was growing up.
Yeah,
that's true. Because of the church, so I didn't even think about it, really. I mean, it wasn't like I was like, oh, I'm going to be the first ordained woman. I didn't have any of that. You know, I grew up always hustling. I mean, we were hustling since we were little. My mom was 35 when she was widowed and she had 5 kids. And it was like, good luck. You have to get money and get yourself together. We were somewhat feral children. But I was a math major in college. And I remember when I graduated with this math degree thinking, I'm going to go to seminary. And that was like one of the first thoughts, thinking, why the hell did I major in math if I was going to go to seminary? And it was like, I just didn't think that far into the future. I love math and I loved, you know, the universal brilliance of systematic thought. I do love that. And so it served me well and it has served me well. But I think the very first time I thought I was going to seminary was right when I graduated from college.
And you went to the University of the South, mm-hmm. which has a beautiful seminary as well. Do you think just being around it was planting those seeds? Or
probably. Don't yeah. you bet? Like osmosis learning is not a bad thing.
That's right.
I went to Vanderbilt Divinity School. I didn't go to Suwannee for Divinity School. I actually had moved to North Carolina for a little bit. Moved to D.C. for a little bit, was working with a group called Bread for the World, but then got a scholarship and came back to Nashville for Vanderbilt Divinity School, where for better or worse, richer or poorer, I met my husband on the first week, and that was it. And I've been in Nashville ever since. Because he was a country music writer. Of course, I married a writer.
Right.
And he had just moved here, and he wasn't going anywhere. And we really bumped into each other in a hallway the very first week of school.
Funny how that works sometimes.
Mm. And I was like, I'm going to marry him. His parents live in Africa. He's a writer. I'm just going to marry him.
And so you,
35 years later, it was a lucky good choice.
That's a good choice. Sometimes it's about never quitting too, but.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Well, you know, one of the things that happened for us during COVID is it was the first time we'd spent that much time together ever.
Yeah.
History of our marriage, raising 3 kids, the whole thing. And it was like so much fun and we loved it. And we kept saying like, boy, that could have gone either way.
I think that's true for a lot of people.
Yeah.
So you go through seminary, you become at some point ordained an Episcopal priest. What is your ministry like early on? Because I think it's changed a lot, right?
No, it's pretty much been the same.
Okay.
I mean, I knew when I got ordained, I was going to start opening houses for women. I knew that's what I wanted to do. So I took a job. My first job as a priest is at Vanderbilt University, where I'm talking to you from. I never left it. I've been here. It's a little chapel that nobody cares at all what you do. It's complete freedom. It's humbling. It's my home. It's where I've started 10 other organizations out of. I love it here and nobody's around. You can see it's dark and quiet. It's this beautiful space. But it was from here that I started the very first community of Thistle Farms in 1997. So basically, I got ordained in 91 and finished up my work at Church of the Resurrection where I was committed. It was out in Franklin, Tennessee. Then I came over here and it took a couple years and I got a board together and started the work in like 1995.
So I've seen you preach a couple times, seen you do a couple of keynotes for the Episcopal Diocese of West Texas. But for those who don't know, talk about what you mean when you say opening homes for women and what the work of Thistle Farms began as and what it is now.
So Thistle Farms is a global movement for women's freedom that began in 1997 here in Nashville, Tennessee, by opening one house, inviting five women who had criminal histories of trafficking and addiction to come and live 2 years rent-free with no authority in the house. And it did really well and it grew, and we knew we needed to start a company because the women had hit the streets on average about 15 years old, and they had a horrible records that prevented them from getting good jobs. And they had lots of folks had low skills. So we started making bath and body care products. And then we grew into a national network, which now has over 600 beds. And then we grew into global partnerships with now more than 1,400 women employed. So it's just been this slow, steady growth of small groups of women who come together to make a big difference.
I love that. And so to kind of go back, you said you sort of always knew you were going to do that work. How did you know that? What was put on your heart? How did that happen for you?
I was raised to root for the underdog. And I think it was my own experience knowing how that sexual abuse had affected my life from an early age that, you know, I wanted to help women who were on the streets. I don't know that I knew our connection. Like I had understood it, but I feel like I had a connection. And so I was drawn to go out and talk to women and to go in the jail and figure out what could we do to be helpful and how can we serve and love each other in a safe community. That was it. It wasn't super complicated.
Yeah. On the Thistle Farms website, there's a quote there that I really like that I think speaks to one of my earlier comments about the importance of language for you across your vocations. And that quote is, "At Thistle Farms, we don't ask, what did you do? We ask, what happened to you?"
In other words, tell us a story, right?
Yeah.
Tell us the story. Because then it's not like there's judgment. It's just about love. Like it's a love story. So tell us the story and how we can engage it.
Talk about your vocation as a writer a little bit. Did that come about because you've always loved language and you've always loved writing, or was this something that you thought could help promote the message of Thistle Farms and the other things you were on about?
I've always loved writing, but I don't have the patience for it. That's my problem.
You've written 11 books, I think, and you don't have the patience for it.
Yeah. No, and I'm really struggling now. I was telling you earlier that I'm writing a murder mystery. So this is my first deep dive really into fiction and trying to understand and learn about real, real writing where you tell the truth in a story that's deeper than just your life experience. And it is a blast, but it's super disciplined and it's super hard for me. Well, mostly I write to get stuff out of my head. You know that feeling?
I do. I have a notebook that is for that purpose. It's not even it's for no one to read. It's just for me to get stuff out of my head. And sometimes it's frightening what comes out of there.
I'll give you an example. Like this morning, did you read the article about UVA or, you know, University of Richmond, maybe? Somebody was taking the name off somebody that had given money to start a law school. So they were removing the person's name from the law school. And I'm reading this article, and the descendants of that person said, "Fine, now you owe us $3.5 billion because that's the worth of that law school today." And they had given, like, the great-great-great-grandfather who owns slaves had given $250,000, and they took his name off. And right when I read that, I thought, oh, my gosh, there's a whole piece in here, like, the guy's basically demanding reparations.
Right.
If you're taking my name off, you have to pay me for this because we spent this money. And now I want all the money back that you're owed me. And it was like, you better be careful because you're talking about reparations and you do not want that if that's where you're headed with it. And he was using horrible language about carpetbaggers, that kind of language.
Wow.
And it was like,
yeah.
Like once that stuff gets into your head, in my mind, like I have to start writing some of it out or it's going to make me crazy all day. Sure. Do you ever get that way?
I do.
You said
yeah,
you have
a, I mean,
just for that.
Yeah, I do. I have a notebook just for getting the stuff out of my head. And a lot of times I use it first thing in the morning, but every once in a while it comes out late at night when I'm laying in bed and there's something in there I can't shake.
Mm. And so what do you do with it?
Nothing. but if I've gotten it out, then I can let it go, right? So that's more of a process for me to just be able to let go of stuff.
And, yeah,
and sometimes it helps me just to think about what is it that I'm thinking, right?
Yes. And it's so writing, it can help me with clarity. It can help me with this anger boiling up in me. It can help me when I'm feeling like overwhelmed with beauty.
Sure.
I mean, all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. It's not always bad things that we need to get out onto paper. In fact, it probably shouldn't be. It's a little like prayer, right? If the only time we pray is when it's, God, I need this from you, then we're probably missing the totality of what that is intended for.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Talk about your writing process. You like pen on paper, pencil, you're on the computer? What is that? How does that work for you?
Well, honestly, the only way I can write, and this has been for decades, is get up early in the morning before everybody's day starts happening to me.
Yep.
And go get in the bathtub.
Okay.
Close the door. I've built a little shelf on my little old school 1940s bathtub. It's not even clawfoot. It's not stunning. It's this just utilitarian, disgusting old bathtub that I've put a plank over with duct tape so I can put this little laptop that I'm using right on it, and I just sit and type.
We drinking tea while that's going on? We drinking coffee or just?
We are always drinking tea. We never drink coffee.
Ever. Right.
We're always having a hot cup of tea, and we always have bath oils in there because I blend oils. So I'm big into the bath oils, and I fill the room, and it's, oh my gosh, it is a little cocoon. I don't know how people write in big spaces. Like I have to have a small space to write in. And then it feels like the thoughts are big.
And are you write every day?
I would say close to every day, because if I'm not writing on my, justice mystery series that I'm working on, I'm writing for newsletter I've printed, that I send out every month, or I'm writing a sermon, or I'm writing a new speech to take on the road. Books are just one tiny part of a larger journey of things I'm committed to writing.
Got it. That makes sense to me. One of the questions, it's one of my favorite questions, Becca, that I always ask all of my guests, and I want to ask you, is to tell me about the last book you read.
Hmm. Oh my gosh. Here's the thing. I've read so many. The one I'm reading right now is about Ireland, and it's called like something like this Happiness Land or something like that. And then I was reading one before that about two brothers it was right at the end of the Civil War, who had escaped slavery and were trying to farm land. I can't remember one single name of them.
That's fine.
Horrible. I read The Last Duel. I just finished that one about 3 weeks ago.
The Last Duel?
Yeah, it was good. Anyway, I read a variety of stuff. I love fiction. I love books that carry me to new worlds that I'm not in currently, instead of just reminding me of how screwed up this one is.
Yeah.
I love poetry. I love biography. I love all of it. One of my favorite books of all time was a biography on Houdini. And I remember reading it going, this is going to change my life. I was probably right at 30 years old. And it was like, this is a whole new way to look at the world. And that's the first time I ever remember, at least, thinking we have to keep reading other people's biographies to look at the world differently.
Yes. And learn from other people's mistakes and learn from what they learn. I mean, to me, books, biographies certainly, but books in general are one of the most powerful things in our world.
Yes.
And if you read a book with the mindset that this is going to change me, it will.
I love that. And I think it's one of the braver things. I mean, I don't think the world needs, you know, more and more people who are so set in their ways and just raising their own banner at the cost of everyone else. But the, like, the brave way to enter the world now is to say things like, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's super brave. Or to say, like, I want to love the world better, so I'm willing to change. Mm. That's like radical now.
Yeah.
Instead of coming out with, like, here's how it is, and if you don't believe this, then you don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. You need to change. No, I'm the one who needs to change here.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. So let me ask, let's say somebody is listening to the podcast or they've read one of your books and they're inspired to take action of some kind to help somebody who needs help. What do you, in your mind, what is the best way to do that? Obviously, we're going to go buy Thistle Farms products, but is it just commerce? Is it just getting money in the right direction? Or is there something you would encourage people to do more?
You know, it's such a good question and people ask it all the time. And I always feel like, I don't know. Do what you need to do. You know what
there
I mean?
You go.
Like,
yeah.
I don't want to say like you're out in Palo Alto, California, and the answer is going to be exactly the same for the person that is sitting in, Orlando, Florida. It's not the same world. It's a different world. And there's different ways to respond to that question. But I do think beginning with an awareness of where you are and who you are is the where to start. Because then you know exactly maybe what it looks like to be a good host for someone.
Mm.
You know, I'm not of the mindset that we have to be doing this heroic work and we do it by ourselves and it's amazing. I think people get to be the hero of their own story, but the world needs a lot more hosts. So when you look at who you are and where you are, what does it mean for you to be a host? And that might mean volunteering. It might mean commerce and trade. It might mean prayer. You know, one of the best activists in the whole world, Dorothy Day, she started the Catholic worker movement. She wrote, you know, towards the end of her life, my work now is prayer. And I love that, like recognizing who you are and where you are, that shifts for people. But the critical thread that runs through it is, are we living our life as this love letter, this way that you feel like you're writing something that is about love? And if it's not, then how do you change the things that make that more lovely?
Yeah.
That's what I would say. So for different people, that answer is super different. And I don't believe in big and small things. I really do believe in doing whatever it is in front of you in a loving way. So the intention is about love, and that's what makes the difference. And that's it. And so, yeah, go ahead, buy your soap from Thistle Farms, you know, volunteer with an organization there, walk instead of drive somewhere if you can, you know, whatever, turn off the water between dishes. I don't know what it is for people.
I love that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Becca, thanks for doing this. Thanks for your time today and for your generosity and for the work you're doing. That work really, really does matter.
Thank you so much, and I hope you have a beautiful day.
Just Just a few quick things before you go. First, thank you so much for listening. It really does mean a lot to me. If you enjoy the show, please consider subscribing to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or Google Podcasts. Commenting on or rating the show would be great too. You can also go to the website, thedecaledge.com, and sign up for our mailing list so you never miss an episode or a blog post. And did you know the Decal Edge has an online bookstore? There's a link at the top of the website where you can find nearly all of the books that we review or discuss. Maybe most importantly, if you're enjoying the show, is to tell a friend about it. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can do it through the contact page on the website. Special thanks to Taylor Weidman for producing the show, for the intro music, and even for designing the Decal Edge logo. I really couldn't do this without Taylor's help, and I'm grateful for his efforts. Want to experience more of Taylor's work? Check out his podcast, the Dharmadillo Podcast. That's it for now. We'll have another episode for you soon. Thanks, and God bless.